It was a pretty slow week, so I thought to myself, maybe we should spice it up a bit. And that's how I got to releasing all of the original Infocom source code. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd,
William Hearn,
and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. Infocom only lasted for about 10 years, from 1979 to 1989, with a little bit of prehistory and a little bit of post-history. But during that time, they released seminal games, games that became part of the canon of owning a computer in the 1980s. Games like Zork, Planetfall, The Witness, Deadline, Trinity, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and so on. They just represented the best of the best, with a sense of being classics, even as they were new. I don't know how many people listen to this podcast who haven't played an Infocom text adventure, but I'm going to assume that you at least have heard of them a little bit. Their big defining feature was full sentence parsing. You could find an area described to you, and then say things like, look in the mailbox and take out the leaflet, and it would work. You would interact with it almost as if you were coming up with a story, and the story was unfolding in front of you. The illusion was almost complete. And the puzzles in an Infocom game were truly exquisite. If you solved one, you felt you had accomplished something, and that you had done it all by yourself. It was actually an MIT paper that I had read in the early 2000s that told me that the story of Infocom, as I kind of vaguely understood it, was a little bit off. What I had kind of picked up was that this was a text adventure company that had gone into business products and in doing so had tanked, when in fact the story was a lot more complicated and a lot more involved. I'm not going to go into it here because I cover it in a documentary feature about Infocom on the documentary GitLamp. But suffice to say that for its short, happy life, Infocom made a difference. During the shooting of GitLamp, I got to know many of the implementers. Really great folks living all over the country who had fine memories of working at Infocom, and each of them brilliant beyond measure and just inspiring interviewees. They let me into their homes, they had meals with me, and they listened to me as I asked more questions and recorded more things involved with the GitLamp documentary. So it was a pretty good experience. And somewhere along the production, somebody wrote me a letter with a very interesting offer. Did I want the Infocom source code? My answer, as usual, was yes. Sure. I'd like to see what you have, or what you claim you have. And when the zip file arrived and I started to paw through it, I realized this was the Infocom source code. This was everything that had been used by the implementers themselves, by the writers of these classics, to create this software. It was in a language I'd never heard of, the Zork implementation language. And to me, somebody who wasn't a great programmer, it was truly odd at how it both explained how adventure games would flow, but was also written in this really strange dialect of colliding keywords and program flow in all sorts of odd directions. The Zork implementation language, or ZIL, was only ever used by a couple dozen people in the main part of its life. It was an extremely focused language for a very small group of people to give to a very, very large audience. But I had it, and a little bit of it went into the GitLamp documentary. It scrolls by trying to explain how strange the language was. I actually run it while Mark Blank explains his thinking. And I really want to highlight one specific part of the Infocom language that makes it so special, and which you've probably heard before, but if you haven't, it blows your mind. You see, Infocom had a problem. They were entering a market where there wasn't just one or two platforms that you had to make your game for. I mean, people would. They might make a game that only played on the Commodore 64 or the Atari 800 or the Tandy Coco. It was a matter of making a game for that platform. And if you were lucky, if the game sold pretty well, then maybe put it somewhere else, maybe a second machine. You would hire someone to code it in, and the amount of backflips they had to do to make it run on the new machine, it might as well have been a whole new program with the same name. But Infocom wanted to be different. And Mark Blank and Dave Lebling and the other programmers, people who were way overqualified to enter this space, came up with a solution so strange and so ahead of its time that it took years for us to see it used in any way like that elsewhere. The Z Machine. A created machine that didn't exist anywhere in the world. It was a completely made-up virtual machine long before anybody would have done anything like this with a microcomputer. It had attributes and a CPU that worked a certain way, and you wrote your language and compiled it into the Z Machine. Then it was a matter of writing interpreters for each of these platforms you wanted to put an Infocom game on. Think of the game as being like gas, and the Z Machine being a perceived engine that sent its output beyond what the machine you were using would use for its own engine. You would take the resulting Z Machine code on each individual platform as if it was written for it. Once that interpreter was written, suddenly they would have 9 or 10 products that could run on that machine. This enabled them to be one of the vendors that had a bunch of games on the Macintosh. This enabled them to be on the Amiga, the Commodore 128, to be on all sorts of obscure machines that had relatively small audiences, but which would suddenly buy every Infocom product because it was working there. It was, in fact, so ahead of its time that it has made the Infocom games future-proof. You can now run an Infocom game on basically any computing platform available today. On phones, on tablets, in web browsers. I attended one vintage computing festival where they had created a hardware Z Machine using some FPGA, enabling you to play Infocom games without any other machine. It was, in other words, a dedicated Infocom machine. Nobody was doing this, and it made them a part of the contemporary space in a way that a lot of other games could not have been. One side effect of this is that the works themselves, the Zork series, Planetfall, Sorcerer, Trinity, and so on, they became ingrained in gaming history and in the minds of gamers. It's possible right now to type in the name of an Infocom game, and it's probably going to be possible to find yourself playing that game within 10 to 15 seconds. It is a living, breathing canon of interactive literature. Oh, sure, we could have arguments about how much it's aged in terms of the puzzle quality or how hard it is to play, but you can experience it immediately. The puzzles inside, the writing inside, some of which has just become part of the background, like you are likely to be eaten by a gru or being a shiny brass lantern nearby. They're just part of being in computers. So when somebody contacted me and said, "Would you like the source code?" I knew I was going to jump at it. And here it was, in my collection, for years. The material that's contained inside of this archive is in the hands of a few people. I don't know all of them. I know it's been passed around, and I know that it's been in some sort of circulation for years. But there's something about spreading it to the public that I felt the whole thing would be improved by. It was a matter of waiting till the right moment, waiting until it seemed to make sense, and then going for it. Frankly, the thing that kind of pushed me along was losing Stu Galley last year. Stu was the creator of a number of games for Infocom, like The Witness and Moon Mist, and he was such a sweet guy when I interviewed him. He was like a grandfather I didn't know I had. We talked about Infocom, and he was totally in support of the project. When it came out, he was even more in support. He was always there, a great voice, and it was a voice that had gone quiet last year. I missed him. I had kind of put to the side that I should hang out with him or have more conversations with him, and here he was, gone. And he had loved Infocom. He had said it clearly in interviews, and he had said it before and after, that Infocom was the dream job he had always wanted, even though he didn't know he wanted it, and the job he would always miss when it was over. Creating interactive fiction wasn't an option for him when he was at MIT, and it wasn't an option for him after he left Infocom. Nobody snapped him up. Nobody took his talent and used it again. He did other very interesting things, but that part of his life had ended, and he missed it. I wanted people to have his name in their minds again, to have the names of all these implementers who had come up with literary works, straight up literary works, that others could play, and did so just because they thought that this would sell well or entertain people, and by showing the source code, I could show the craft of what was behind it. Years ago, I had helped recover the Prince of Persia source code for the Apple II, along with the help of a gentleman named Tony Diaz and with the assistance of Jordan Mechner, the creator. And at the time, I just decided the best way to get people's attention would be to put it on GitHub. I don't know what it is about GitHub that I like so much, but I think part of it is how it's a hotbox for collaboration and sharing code. And even though my personal experience with Git, the source code management software, is that it is a painful process, and you'll realize why GitHub is worth billions for making it slightly easier to use, there's just something magical about putting things up, letting people share them, and then in some small way, collaborate with them. People took the Prince of Persia source code and created additional branches that added comments or modified it so the copy protection was gone. It was fun to watch, and I wanted to see that again. So I created an account called Historical Source with an eye that it wouldn't stop with Infocom, and then put up all of the Infocom games. This actually presented a problem in terms of making it accessible, because it had been a working directory that had gotten frozen in time and then never really dealt with again. Newly done revisions that were done for reasons I didn't understand stood against classic versions that had been released, along with modifications with odd features or for platforms it never came out with, even games that had never been released. I like to think that I did it in a way that made sense, and when I put it out there, people told me it generally did. Usually what I would do is try to figure out which version came first, check that all into GitHub, and then check in later revisions along with a comment. People have used that to find differences in the code and where things were rewritten or modified to make them either easier or just not in the game because they were going for a smaller platform or an easier-to-use puzzle. And once I checked it all in, it was so fascinating to see how fast it moved around. Within a day, there were thousands upon thousands of clones. There were news articles being written about it. And most important to me, there was a renewed interest in the Zork implementation language. I said that it was impossible to compile. This turned out to be not true. There was a group that had been working for some time on a from-the-outside compiler called Zilf that would do the work of the compiler that was lost from the data I had. It was possible and had been done by a small group of people to write programs in the original Zork implementation language, compile them, and have them playable on the interpreters that were originally written for the Infocom games. That group, currently on Facebook, started to get dozens of new members, people who didn't know this was an option, who wanted to learn exactly how Zil worked and maybe write new things in it. GitHub, for their part, did two things that have knocked my socks off. First, they have a program called Linguist. It detects what computer language something is written in and then highlights the syntax in color to make it easier to read. And within 24 hours, using a module that was available from one of these groups, they had it working on GitHub. GitHub was printing Zil. Then they contacted me and asked me if I wanted to go on a live stream to discuss Zil. And I said yes, but I also said, why not have one of the implementers with me? So we reached out to Steve Moretzky, creator of so many great Infocom games, and he said yes, except he was only available on one day, and that wasn't a day that I was available. Luckily for everyone, I reached out to just the person to be there, Kevin Savitz, who flew in from Portland and did the interview live streamed with Steve Moretzky. I wasn't anywhere to be found except for a picture and a slide, and that suits me fine. So here we are in a world where the Infocom source code is now going to be found everywhere. Whatever else happens, we have those materials to reference. We understand Infocom that much better. This is what I really want to bring forward to people. There is, depending on how you look at it, either a lot of source code out there or none at all. Older programs, many of them important works in computer history, don't have source code available for us to study. We can disassemble the binaries, but we won't see the comments, we won't see the layout, we won't see the thinking that went into it. We certainly won't see things that didn't end up in the final product, modules and approaches that they took and then decided against or which didn't work in a way they wanted to. We won't see alternate names, alternate documents that tell us where things might have gone instead of where they are. But every time we get our hands on another cache of source code, another little insight into how these things were made, I think our history of this culture becomes that much smarter, that much more informed. And I would like to hope that each time it happens, somebody looks up, thinks about what's in their attic, and thinks about giving me a call. This is Jason Scott, Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Beghoyanu, Forrest Fuqua, Mark Pilgrim, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. My financial life has been a whirlwind of deductions, business expenses, and figuring out what I owe for a very large 1040 for 2018. It's my big remaining debt right now. I'm going to figure out exactly how much I owe, make arrangements, and then start paying it off. Everything after that initial payoff will go into savings to pay the 2019 taxes. I'm fairly sure I can bring this sort of treadmill to a close. And maybe we will hit a point that the podcast doesn't make any sense to do. But I think I've still got quite a few stories in me, and if you'll be patient as I come out with more, I hope you'll enjoy them too.